Okay, good morning, ladies. Here we are finishing up God of Creation study, right? We got wrap-up week still to come, but this is our last intense study week, and so I'm glad that you've made it. Good job. And we get two genealogies to end with, and Babel right in the middle. So we're going to actually move fairly quickly through the genealogies. There are some important things there, and Jen highlighted some of those in her teaching as well. So I do want to touch on a few things, but we're going to spend most of our time on Babel, because that's really where the Lord spoke to me and gave me a lot of application for my own life, and that's what I'd like to share with you mostly this morning. But let's start off with Genesis 10 and the genealogy we have there. You remember back in Genesis 5, we had another genealogy. And in that other genealogy, we heard this refrain, right? We heard the refrain and had other sons and daughters. And we heard the refrain and he died. And we get a different refrain in this genealogy, don't we? It's actually quite different. I had never taken the time to really think about the differences, but based on the purpose of these genealogies, they're really quite different. The refrain that we hear in this genealogy, we see four times. We see it in verse 5, in verse 10, in verse 31, and in verse 32. And I'm just going to read 32 for you because it's very clear there. What the purpose of this genealogy is. So in 10:32, it says, "These are the clans of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies, in their nations. And from these, the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood." And I feel like, hang on just a moment. Okay, yeah. And so what we hear here is that this genealogy isn't actually about the people, right? So the genealogy we looked at in chapter 5, we went from generation to generation, and in each generation we got one son, mostly, right? And then they had other sons and daughters, and then they died, and then the next generation had this particular son that's mentioned, and other sons and daughters, and then they died. But in this genealogy, we don't see it moving through like that. We don't hear about other sons and daughters. Instead, in each generation, we hear about many, don't we? It spreads outward instead of downward because it's showing us how these various nations and people groups are established. Now, why is it showing us that? Well, because back in Genesis 9:1, after the flood, right, God had given a command to Moses. He said, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." And so what we see in Genesis 10, and I think the reason that Moses goes here, as we're going to see, this is not in chronological order when we get to chapter 11, we're going to see that. But the reason I think that Moses emphasizes this first is to show the fulfillment of that command. This is a genealogy of nations. Right? And it's showing us how the earth is filled. And it talks about languages and people groups and nations. In fact, there's 70, if you count them up, 70 different nations and people groups listed here. And I love that because that shows us something of the heart of God our Father. Right? He is not, even though he chooses, as we'll see when we start into Abram, he chooses a nation and a people as his own. That's not the only nation and people that he's worried about, that he loves, right? He takes the time to show us here all of these nations. He's a God of the nations. And so our purpose in reading this genealogy in 10 is to see those nations spread. And we get in the very first section in Genesis 10, 2 through 5, we have a very brief treatment, actually, of Japheth's line. And someone asked me this week, why start with Japheth? And the scholars say there might be a couple of reasons, either because he's the eldest of the brothers, so we naturally start there, or because these are the nation groups that are the most remote from Israel, right, in terms of where they live, in terms of their interaction with them. They would be the remotest from Israel. And Jen Wilkin does a great job of outlining what these nation groups might be in our current understanding of peoples and nations. So if you haven't listened to her yet, I would encourage you to go there. It's very interesting to see how these people groups, how they've been shown to line up with people groups we're familiar with and hear about today. But it's a brief treatment of Japheth. And we get a more detailed treatment of Ham's line in 10, 6 through 20. And it's really interesting to see the similarities here, right? We do have very different genealogies from chapter 5 and this chapter 10, but there are some interesting similarities. And one of those similarities is seeing this righteous line and the unrighteous line. So you'll remember back in Genesis 5, we looked first at Cain's line, and it was brief. There was about 7, and when they stopped with Lamech. Remember that? And we saw the character of Lamech. We talked about that he was a man of violence, that he was proud of his violence, that he was likely oppressive, right? Even in the way that he speaks to his wives, we get a suggestion of that, and that he was presumptuous, right, of God and his protection of him. And so as we look at Ham's line, which we know because Noah has cursed the line of Ham, right? He cursed Canaan. That's God's curse coming through Noah. We know this is the unrighteous line. And we get to see some overlaps in those two unrighteous lines. For example, just as we stopped and looked at Lamech more clearly and considered some of the details of his life, here as we start into the line of Ham, we stop and look at some details of one of the lives of the men in this line, of Nimrod, right? So fairly quickly there in 10:8 we see Cush fathered Nimrod. And it says, he was the first one on earth to be a mighty man. Now, that, again, tricks us, doesn't it? Mighty man sounds like a good thing. But remember back to last time I taught in Genesis 6 when we looked at the mighty men that were listed there. In Genesis 6:4, we looked at the Nephilim. We talked about how Nephilim, that word, means fell, and it's likely because the faces of people fell when they saw these men, or they literally fell to the ground out of fear because these were mighty men and men of renown. And so those mighty men, back in chapter 6, were associated with oppression and violence, right, and conquest over people. And it was right in that context of explaining just how bad things had gotten before the flood. Right, so we hear about those mighty men in 6:4, and in 6:5 is where it says that the evil within men's hearts, right, that men's hearts were only evil continually, all of those adjectives that emphasize just how badly it had gotten. Those two things are right together. So we know that this term mighty men is a negative one, and it refers to oppression and violence. And so when we hear Nimrod is a mighty man, that should come to our mind. Not a good mighty man, okay, but an oppressive, violent man. The name Nimrod actually means, literally, we shall rebel. So another clue, that as we're looking at Ham's line, we are not looking at a favorable development of character here. And we hear then how Nimrod, as we pause and look at him, he begins his kingdom, and one of those cities that is associated with his kingdom is Babel, which we're going to spend a lot more time on, right, in just a few minutes. So we get an idea of the kind of people he's associated with, and we see that he conquers. He's really the first conqueror that we see mentioned in Scripture. He builds other major cities, and he says he conquers all of Shinar, which is the ancient name for Mesopotamia. So just like we saw with Lamech, we get a hint here, just in a couple generations from Ham, where this line is going. Oppression, violence, rebellion. Okay, this is the unrighteous line. And it becomes even more clear as we continue reading, because we hear some names that, if you've read on in the Old Testament, which most of you have, are going to sort of sound familiar to you, right? A lot of ites. We hear about Egypt and Canaan, the Philistines, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, right? That whole list of those nations and peoples is a list of the enemies of Israel. And Moses' audience would have known that well, wouldn't they? They are just about to go into the promised land, remember? And conquer many of these people groups, right? And take the land from many of them. And so Moses wants to remind them, look how far back this has gone. These people groups come from the unrighteous line. They have been cursed, right, as they come through the line of Ham. And so Jen said, actually, that this list of names of people groups is found 19 other times, just as it is in the Old Testament, as a list of the enemies of Israel. And so we see this unrighteous line, and we see this wickedness, and Moses' audience would have known it well. We also see it even in the places mentioned, right, as we know more of what's coming, Sodom and Gomorrah. We associate quite easily with wickedness and growing sin. And so that's what we're finding here in this section of Genesis 10, is the unrighteous line of Ham, I'm sorry, and the result of that unrighteousness, the growing, the deepening, the spreading of wickedness and rebellion. And then we come to Genesis 10:21, to the line of Shem. And we know, based on what Noah has prophesied, really, about these various lines, we know that the line of Shem is blessed, right? We know that it is associated with the Lord God. And in Genesis 10:21, it opens up and it gives Shem two titles, both of which are actually quite significant. So Genesis 10:21 says, "To Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the elder brother of Japheth, children were born." So these two titles given to Shem. The first is the father of the children of Eber. And you probably noticed as you kept on reading, well, Eber's not actually his son, right? Eber's his great-grandson. And so you have to go down a few lines to find that name Eber. And yet here, when the line of Shem is being introduced, we hear of Eber. Why do we hear of Eber? Well, if you add an H there to the front of Eber, you can easily see that this is the root word for the Hebrews, right? And we're going to hear about that again, aren't we? Starting in Genesis 14:13, where Abraham is called a Hebrew, right? Abram at that time is called a Hebrew. Shem is given the honor of being identified as the father of the Hebrews, which would become a name used for the people of God. We also hear that Shem receives the title, the elder brother of Japheth, or it's sometimes translated the brother of Japheth the elder, depending on, I'm not sure which is most correct, but it's translated both ways. So this one's really interesting because Jen had us look in on our map, right? She had us look at where these various people groups would have ended up. And when we looked at where Japheth ended up, you colored in with your pencil. And then if we were to take a map, she said, of the time of Acts, right? So when the gospel is first going forth and you overlaid it, those places where Japheth ended up would have been the first people groups of the Gentiles where the gospel moved out. Okay, so there's an association of these nations of Japheth with the Gentiles who would hear the gospel, which is quite significant if we think about God's intention, right, was never just for the people of Israel. And we hear that in the blessing that Noah gave. He did not only give the blessing to Shem, right? There was also Japheth was going to come and dwell in the tent of Shem. And as we understand Japheth to be those Gentile nations, we see this dwelling together. Matthew Henry puts it really well. I've got it written for you here under Genesis 10. referring to this title that is given to Shem and why is it there. He says, probably this title was intended to signify the union of the Gentiles with the Jews in the church. The sacred historian had mentioned it as Shem's honor that he was the father of the Hebrews. But lest Japheth's seed should therefore be looked upon as forever shut out from the church, he here reminds us that he was the brother of Japheth, not in birth only, but in blessing. For Japheth was to dwell in the tents of Shem. Beautiful, isn't it? I mean, that's one of those things that I'm like, oh yeah, I should read genealogies and maybe a commentary or two to help me find those things, right? Because, yes, from the beginning, the Lord intended, right, that we as Gentiles would come as guests into the tent of Shem and that we would be unified in the church of God, that tent, the church of God, right? And that they both are blessed to dwell there. So really beautiful picture of God's heart for the nations and intention all along, right, to pull in nations under his church, under his tent. So that is as much as we're going to do with Genesis 10. As I mentioned, Jen does a great job of showing you some modern overlaps with these people groups. So go there if you would like to know more. Now we come to chapter 11. And the Tower of Babel. And I mentioned before that we are not in chronological order here, and that becomes very obvious from the first verse of chapter 11, where it says, now the whole earth had one language and the same words. Right? And we just read in chapter 10, in three different verses, how they were actually divided up, right, by people group and by language. Just for example, from Genesis 10:5, from Japheth's line, from these the coastland peoples spread in their lands, each with his own language, by their clans in their nations. So, wait. Okay, in chapter 10 we hear about all these different nation groups and they're going out by their languages, right, in their clans, in their nations, and that's repeated over and over again. The last time being in verse 31, just two verses before we get to chapter 11, and then he says in the first verse of chapter 11, there was only one language. So we know, that's our clue, okay, this is not in chronological order. Babel would have happened prior to the spreading out of nations by language. And so we talked about why Moses did it that way. He wanted to show the fulfillment of the command to disperse throughout the earth and to fill it. And now he's coming back to explain just exactly how that happened. And sadly, though not surprisingly, it was not through obedience to God's command. It was actually through disobedience and rebellion. And that's what I want to dwell on today, is these builders at Babel. And not only what they teach us about how the world was filled and how these nation groups were dispersed, but what they show us about ourselves. Right? It's a mirror to us. So let's look at Genesis 11, 1 through 4. It says, now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Remember Shinar, associated with Nimrod. Okay, so we have some idea even from that. Where we're headed with this story. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. So what we see is four things here. We find them all in verse 4. Of what they did and their motivations for doing it. So first, it says that they build a city. And I think I've always skipped over that one when I'm thinking about Babel. I go straight to the tower that they built. But actually, it's quite significant that they built a city. It shows us something of their heart. They were interested in security, right? So they had been told to disperse, to fill the earth. That was the command of God. But we saw with Cain also, when he was told, when he was said he would be a wanderer on the earth, what did he do? He built a city, right? He named it Enoch. And the city, when we think of a city, we don't necessarily think solely of population, but a fortress. Okay, something that is a means of protection. And as they come together, they're trying to protect themselves. And so when we hear that they built a city, we should, and Moses' audience would have understood, they weren't fulfilling God's command. They were seeking to establish security and protection through their own hand. And this is the first place where I see myself, sadly mirrored, how much I try to build my own security. And for each of these, I just thought, I'll share just a little bit of how I see that playing out in my life today. And one of the ways I see myself struggling with wanting to build and provide my own security is, if you know me very well at all, you know I really struggle with how I spend my time. I do a lot of internal battle about what's the appropriate way to use those 7 hours a day when my children are in school. And part of that, I think, is good. But part of that is coming from fear, right? I am afraid that by choosing not to work and make money at this time in my life, I am not providing a college fund for my children. I am not adding to our retirement fund. And I'm scared that one day I'm going to look back 20 years from now and I'm going to say, you fool. What were you thinking? That you just had all the time in the world to, you know, do these other things. You were foolish, Amy, and you should have thought ahead, and you should have prepared, and you should have saved, right? And then you wouldn't be in this position. So I have a lot of fear revolved around this idea of security. And it affects my day-to-day life and how I feel about the way I spend my time quite drastically right now. And the Lord used this to help remind me, Amy, you're trying to build your own security. Do you think I won't be God to you then like I'm God to you now? If I have given you these things to do with your days and you believe that these are from me and that you are using your time faithfully, do you really think I'm going to abandon you 20 years from now and there's going to be no way for your girls to go to college or for you to retire or to have the means that you need to live off of? Really? And yet, how often the fear comes, right? I want to build my own security. I want to say, look what I did to provide for myself and my family. And God says, no, I want you to trust me. I'm dispersing, right? And you're to trust me in that, not try to build it yourself. And so, I am not so different from the builders at Babel. I would like to build my own security. And it's a battle to say, okay, Lord, I'm going to lay that down and trust you. The second thing we see here is that the tower, they build a tower. So they do build a tower. And Jen talks about how it's actually more of a staircase than a tower, which I think is actually quite helpful for us to see the intention that they have in building it. Think of a place where you can move up, right? A tower that reaches to heaven. And here what I see is a love of position and control, right? They wanted to elevate themselves higher. They were grasping to be where God is, to take his position. In fact, Jen has us look at the language used here. Come, let us make bricks. Come, let us build a city and a tower. Come, let us, right? And she had us go back to Genesis 1:26 and look at that language. And lo and behold, it's the language of God when he's creating mankind. And he says, come, let us, right? That is the position of God, not the position of man. And yet they are trying to usurp, trying to take over that position. And so they build a tower to get up to his position. God sits on his throne as king, and they are trying to get there. We see them grasping, just as Adam grasped through eating the fruit, and Eve grasped to be like God, right? And unfortunately, I see that in myself as well, right? How often I want to sit on the throne of my own life. I want to take control and say, no, no, this is how it should go. You don't have that position. It's come up in a lot of areas of my life lately, and Bill has touched on it in a couple of sermons these past few Sundays, this idea of being creatures, that we are not self-determining, that we are not autonomous. We are created beings, and we have a creator who is over us. And man, that seems basic, doesn't it? But yet, how often I function and think not as a creature, right? But as one who does get to determine my life and my worth and how I spend my time, right? Instead of understanding, if God has me doing mundane things for his glory, so be it, right? He creates vessels for different uses. And so, yet I try to take that position. I want to build that staircase and sit up there in the heavens. Number three, they also say, let us make a name for ourselves. And we see here a love of praise. And I really liked what John Calvin had to say about this. I put it on your sheet. It says, this is the perpetual infatuation of the world. To neglect heaven and to seek immortality on earth, where everything is fading and transient. And if someone had asked me, Amy, are you seeking immortality on earth and neglecting heaven? I would say, no, no, I'm not. But as I reflected on my love of praise, the praise of men, I was reminded of a conversation I had with my dad over the weekend. We're reading, we have a little family book club because we're kind of like that, and we're reading a book named Seven Women and the Secret of Their Greatness by Eric Metaxas. It covers, it's a biography book, but it has short biographies of women like Mother Teresa, Joan of Arc, Susanna Wesley, Corrie ten Boom. Okay, pretty impressive ladies, pretty impressive lives. And my dad and I were talking about it. We both finished the book, and he wanted to know which one was my favorite of the biographies. And I was like, you know, Dad, I was like, every single one of them made me feel like I've done nothing with my life. I was so intimidated by what they accomplished and who they were and the ways that they sacrificed themselves. And I said, I came away feeling like a total failure, you know? And that's when I realized, that's when I saw it. My reaction to lives of faithfulness and courage was to say, I'm not good enough. Instead of being thankful to the Lord, the ways that these women's have impacted the world, or instead of being encouraged by the way God used people, right, to accomplish his good things on earth, I come back and I look at myself and I say, I want a chapter in a book. I'd like someone to write one about me. I'd like someone to look at my life and say, wow. Right? And there it is. I'm seeking immortality on earth, and I'm neglecting heaven. Instead of serving the Lord, I'm looking at how do people look at me? What are they going to say about me? And so, let us make a name for ourselves is not too far from my own heart. It's another battle we have to fight. Finally, the last thing that we see here in verse 4 is, lest we be dispersed, or lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth. And we already talked about God's command to them was indeed to be dispersed and scattered. Go and fill, right? Spread out over the face of the whole earth. That was his intention for them. And yet they had a love of their own way. They said, no. No, we're going to live together, we're going to die together, we're going to stick together. We're not going to do it your way. And that, too, I find myself in. I could have picked any number of verses, but the first one that came to mind when I thought of doing things my own way was John 12:24. Jesus is speaking. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. So Jesus is giving us here his way. His way involves death to self, right? That fruit may come. And yet, my way, the way I want to do it does not involve death to self, right? I want to have a fruitful life, sure, but not by dying to my own desires and needs. I would like to have them both, please, right? And he says, no, this is my way. This is my way. And I, just like them, say, lest I have to die to self, I'll do it my own way, right? And so, these Babel builders that we can so easily write off as fools are not so far, not from my heart, right? But for the grace of God go I. And I think we see in them a picture of what we have to do battle with and what we have to surrender before the Lord and say, yeah, that's in my heart. That is in my heart. And I see by their lives that that is rebellion against God, right? Okay. So now we get to look at God's response in 11:5-9. Okay. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower. Notice, the Lord came down, right? They said they were building a tower to heaven. Did they make it? Clearly not. Obviously, God could have seen, right? He sees everything. He's everywhere. It's not that God literally couldn't see. Moses is emphasizing here how ludicrous the claim that they were going to build a tower to heaven. God had to come down, right, to see it. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. Also interesting in this verse, children of man can be translated sons of Adam. Right, Adam and man would be the same word in Hebrew. And if we think of it as sons of Adam, we can more clearly see that sin, that rebellion, that grasping to be like God coming down through the generations, right? They are behaving just as Adam did. They are his sons. Verse 6, and the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. In previous readings of this passage, I've always been a bit confused by God's words here. It always came across to me as if God was somehow threatened by man or by humans and what they could do when they got together. Right, something about the way that it's spoken, that nothing they propose to do will be impossible for them, right? And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And I was kind of confused by that. Why would God be threatened by what man's able to do? He's God, and we're man, and he could just destroy us, although he promised not to. So what's going on here? And I think what we see is this is not a power play. Right? But this is the mercy of restraint. There is mercy here in God's judgment on them, and it's mercy that provides a good restraint for them. We see it in Matthew Henry at the bottom of your page. He considers the mercy and the restraint given here by the judgment of God. So he's talking about God and what he could have done, and then what he did do. It says he, or God, does not say, let us go down now in thunder and lightning and consume those rebels in a moment, or let the earth open and swallow them up and their building, and let those go down quickly into hell who are climbing to heaven the wrong way. No, only let us go down and scatter them. They deserve death, but are only banished or transported. For the patience of God is very great towards a provoking world. Punishments are chiefly reserved for the future state. God's judgments on sinners in this life, compared with those which are reserved, are little more than restraints. So what God does here by confusing their languages is to restrain the spread of sin. and restrain the wickedness and rebellion. Right? He puts limitations on it by confusing their language. They had been encouraging one another in this sinfulness. Come, let us, right? That language not only echoes God, but also indicates a communal decision, a communal action. They were encouraging one another in this pursuit of God's position and in this rebellion. And the potential for wickedness to grow rampant, we know was there. We saw it before the flood, right? We know how bad it got. And we understand that God had given a command, and they had ignored it and gone the other way. God had said, disperse, go, fill the earth. And they had said, no. So a command wasn't sufficient. He had to put on restraints. And notice that those restraints are limitations. By mixing up the languages so they couldn't communicate well to one another, what does it lead to? Dispersing, which was what they were supposed to do originally. So those restraints that he placed on them, rather than bringing destruction or something bad, actually allowed for obedience, forced it in some way, right? And as I was reflecting on this, I was thinking about how crucial that is to our own understanding of God's restraints in our lives and how I don't react to them in light of this, right? We remember back in the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve, they were required to leave the garden, and we talked about why did they have to leave the garden? So that they wouldn't take of the fruit of the tree of life and live forever in their state of sinfulness. Another instance where a restraint or a limitation put upon them was to contain the sin and wickedness to a finite period of time and to move them out, right? It kept their longevity and the extent of their sinfulness contained, that restraint of God. And when I think about this in regard to my own life, there are some limitations that God has put upon me as a human being that I fight against, right? And I don't look at it as, oh, God must be doing a good thing here. I think, why must I be limited in this way? I would assume that all of us have areas of limitation that we rage against and we are frustrated by, and we don't understand how this could be good. I've been doing a lot of writing this semester. That's one of the things I focused my time on, hopefully for good. But I've been writing a lot of stories, and it was interesting. As I was reading through some of them, I realized that I was writing about the same thing without knowing I was writing about the same thing, which often happens, I think. But a lot of my stories are kind of raging against the restriction of time, that we're limited by it, that my children's lives are passing in front of my eyes and I cannot hold them back, right? That my father and my mother are aging before my eyes and I cannot pull them back. That I, myself, am frustrated at the end of a day that I didn't get things done that I wanted to get done because I'm constrained by time. I live inside of it and I am frustrated by it. And one of the stories that I wrote focused on this poem by Dylan Thomas. It's on the back here for you. I wanted to give you just a taste of what that looks like in my life as I struggle against it. I've only included two stanzas here. This was a poem written as his father was dying. So he says, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." And the story I wrote was about a woman, me, trying to get her parents to rage, trying to rage on their behalf when she sees them sort of accepting, right, what is coming and what is inevitable for all of us. And I realized as I was reading back over it and thinking through it that I was raging against this limitation that God had put, right? I was not accepting the goodness of God in restricting our time on earth, right? Our sin is finite, because once we're done here, it's over, right? As we go and live in glory. And that's a good thing, that it's finite, that he limits the longevity and the extent of our sin by limiting our lives. It is a good thing. And I was taken to Acts 17, 25 through 28, which I've put here on your sheet. God himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth. Do you hear echoes of Babel? He intended for us to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times. That one's for me. I rage against time. And the boundaries of their habitation. Babel again, right? That they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. And as I meditated on this verse, I realized I am raging against the appointed times that God has set for my parents, for my children, for myself. Right? I'm resisting that limitation, that restraint. Just as the people of Babylon did not want to live on all the face of the earth and did not want the boundaries of their habitation established for them. Me and the builders at Babel are both right here in this verse, and we're both raging against the limitations. And yet, look at the bookends. God himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. For in him we live and move and have our being. We are creatures. I have no right to rage. Right? As powerful as that poem is, it's not my worldview. Of course, death is not what was intended for us. And so raging against it in some sense is appropriate. But also surrendering to the fact that God appoints our times. And that restriction is a good thing, right? That's what we see here in the Tower of Babel. It leads to obedience. It leads to a lessening of the extent and longevity of sin. And so as you do battle and feel yourself raging and resisting those limitations, whatever they are, that God has placed upon your life, I want you to remember Babel. It was for good that he did it. Right? And he could, had he been doing it for judgment or for punishment, it would have looked much different. It was for good. It was for obedience. It was for his plan to be fulfilled that he put those restrictions in place. And he's doing the same thing in your life. Not only does he restrain for our good, last point here, he restrains for his glory. We get to see, as we look forward into the New Testament, how this division of peoples into languages and nations actually increases the glory of God. This is my favorite part. We get to see at Pentecost in Acts 2, right? When the Tower of Babel is briefly reversed, when those preaching the gospel are preaching in tongues they don't know, and the people hearing it are hearing it in their own language, and this division of languages and confusion of languages is momentarily overcome, because that's the power of the gospel and the power of the Holy Spirit going forth, right? And we would have missed that had there not been different languages. We wouldn't have seen that display of the Spirit and the gospel. We get to see it. That God, the authority and power of Jesus is magnified by the fact that he can reach into every single culture and into every single language, right? And the gospel can be known despite the major differences. Think of how different you are from some of your brothers and sisters in Christ that live in different parts of the world. I mean, everything about our lives is different from theirs. And yet the gospel is true for them, and it's true for us. It's true for that single mother in Haiti who's trying to make ends meet in some sort of a house, as it is for me, living in my very comfortable home here in Lawrence, Kansas. And the aspects of it that aren't true for her can't be true for me, right? It has to be true for all of us. And that shows us the glory and the power and the authority of Jesus. Piper says it really well in a sermon I would highly recommend. called The Pride of Babel and the Praise of Christ. It's listed here at the end of this next quotation. It's a very good sermon on Babel. Says, the authority and power of Jesus is magnified because he lays claim on every language group and every people. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations. Yes, in response to sin, God has divided the languages and the nations, but in the end, it magnifies the authority and power of Christ to make disciples in every language. His power is all the more glorious because it breaks into so many different languages and peoples and brings salvation. Right? And we see, too, not only the authority and power of Jesus, but the beauty that we will experience at the throne of God in eternity is magnified. The glory of it is even more beautiful because all the nations will come. Revelation 7, which is the last passage I have here on your sheet. Revelation 7, 9 and 10. After this I looked and behold a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands and crying out with a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. Notice the repetition. Every nation, all tribes and peoples and languages. The emphasis is really there, right? How much more beautiful, how much more glorious will that worship be? Because we see that he has faithfully brought in from every single one. And there we will stand all together and worship at his throne. And so, we see here in Genesis, as we have so often, in the midst of human sin and rightful punishment, the mercy, the goodness, the glory of God. And we see that his restraints on our lives are not only for our good, but will ultimately bring him so much glory. And so we should surrender and we should thank him that we are limited creatures and that those things are for his glory and our good. As I expected, I don't have much time for the line of Shem at the end of chapter 11. Perhaps whomever's doing next week can take it up. I'll mention just a few things here. God shows here in the context of having all these nations created that he's going to choose one. So we learn something about who God is by choosing one, though we already know, right, that those Japheth is going to be brought in under the tent of Shem. So he's not ultimately leaving out these other nations, but that he chooses to work through one. We're going to see here as we go to Abram, and next semester as we look at Abram and his family and move forward with God's covenant, we see the blessing of the line of Shem, right? Just as the righteous line of Seth went from Seth to Noah, and then God interacts with Noah and provides salvation through him. We see this righteous line goes from Shem to Abram, and then God interacts with Abram and gives his blessing and brings ultimately salvation through him, right? So we see this consistency in the blessing of the righteous line. We also see the continuation of the promise made to Eve. Remember back in Genesis 3, he said that through her offspring, the head of the serpent would be crushed. And now we can take from Adam and Eve, we can take Seth's line all the way to Noah. And now, starting here, we can take Noah and Shem all the way to Abram, right? And we're going to be able to eventually take Abram all the way to Jesus. And so by having this here, we get to trace the promise and the fulfillment of that promise through Christ coming as God said it would through Eve's offspring, right? So it is significant, and I'm sorry I don't have time for more there, but we have a few notes there at the end. Okay, let me close us in a word of prayer. Father God, thank you for your word and how it surprises us so often that we find ourselves in it in encouraging ways and in challenging ways, and that we hear your voice through it, even if it's a story we've read before or a genealogy we think quite irrelevant. Lord, thank you that your word is living and active and that it is at work in our lives. And I pray that as we go forth into the world, that we would do so with minds that have been transformed by your truth, and that we would not continue to look at the world in the way that we did earlier today, but that we would have in mind these truths from you, the ways your Spirit has touched our hearts, and we would adjust and transform in accordance with who you are and who we are and what eternity holds. I pray these things in the name of Jesus. Amen.